Call the Senate Finance Committee to order afternoon of March 23rd, 2026. We're in the state capitol. Present today, Chairman Stedman Olson, Senators Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have one item on today's agenda. That is a Treasury cash flow and investment fund update with a presentation by the Department of Revenue. Please come forward, introduce yourselves. I think we have three individuals, Janelle Earls, Pamela Leary, and Zachary Hanna. We're here to be enlightened.
Thank you, Chair Hoffman. For the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. I'm here today to introduce our Chief Investment Officer, Zach Hanna, and Treasury Director, Pam Leary. They will do the presenting, and I will be here for any questions that they can answer.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pam Leary. I'm the Director of the Treasury Division. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you. So slide two is our agenda. First, we're going to introduce you to the functions in Treasury, discuss cash management, followed by an update of Treasury's investment funds and a discussion of the investment options of the participant-directed retirement plans overseen by the ARM Board. And go to slide four. Slide four is a chart that shows the four sections in the Treasury Division that touch investments and cash flows. We have 40 professionals that work in these sections with strong longevity. In fact, Treasury leadership has an average of 17 years at the Treasury. Many of our staff have professional designations, such as a CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst, like CIO Hannah, and CPAs, Certified Public Accountants, like me. The box in red shows the portfolio management team, also called the front office, where 16 investment staff invest the assets for state fiduciaries. The team performs or oversees 120,000 trades annually, develops asset allocations and investment policies on behalf of hundreds of state accounts that roll into 45 investment funds utilizing 30 investment pools, supported by about 150 investment managers and over 700 private equity funds. That is a lot, and about half of those assets are managed internally. You'll hear more about the investment process later from CIO Hannah. The green box is the accounting and operations side of the house, also referred to as the back office, which ensures that those 120,000 trades and all costs are directed and accounted for in the correct amounts in the correct funds. The purple box in the lower left-hand side is our middle office, where compliance and performance reporting is housed. The compliance group helps protect invested assets by monitoring adherence to existing laws, rules, regulations, contracts, policies, and guidelines. They perform more than 75 compliance tests on trades daily. The performance group calculates performance for 45 funds every single day. This group also supports the other sections as the data management center, bringing technology into our daily practice to make us more efficient and knowledgeable and able to do what we can do these days with the same number of people we've had for a very long time. Cash management in the teal-colored box is arguably one of the most important central functions provided to the state, processing thousands of transactions daily that support the revenue expenditures in the accounting system. They oversee all the cash flows into and out of the state to ensure that the general fund has sufficient balances to pay our bills. They also coordinate with our investment team to maximize our invested cash amounts every day. I'll talk a little bit more about cash management in the next few slides, but I'll say that managing cash flows and investing almost $60 billion in numerous investment funds is as complex as it sounds. And I would take this opportunity to acknowledge our very skilled professionals and team for the work they do and the strong track record that they have. On to slide 6 to take a deeper dive into cash management. Cash management provides many core services to the state, from maintaining bank contracts for depository services and credit card acceptance programs to working with departments on federal programs. But again, the most important daily task they have is to manage states' cash flows. As the graphic on the right shows, cash inflows from tax revenue, federal programs, agency receipts, and reserves, and cash outflows are made to pay for payroll, pensions, Medicaid, permanent fund dividends, to name a few. The cash management team is experienced in working with the state's reserves to ensure we have sufficient cash balances to pay our bills. On slide 7, we have detailed why we have revenue and expenditure uncertainty. Unrestricted general fund revenue comes from two main sources, as you heard last week, oil revenue and investment earnings. Oil is a commodity, and it's quite volatile, both in terms of price and quantity. The revenue from the permanent fund investments is much less volatile due to the percent of market value formula that provides certainty in the current and next year. Further, because investments are providing a greater share of unrestricted general fund revenue, we have a bit more certainty with the revenues, at least in the short term. While expenditures are generally planned, there can be uncertainty in terms of amounts and timing. And these fall into a couple of categories. For example, most federal programs require expenditures to be made before reimbursement from the feds, so there's always money going out the door before it comes in. Also, there tends to be larger appropriations at the beginning of every fiscal year, so funds need to be available for those. Slide 8 defines cash flow deficiencies and revenue shortfalls and how we deal with them. Over time, as more and more subfunds were created, the general fund proper had less money to pay our bills, resulting in the need to monitor our cash balance even more closely. Cash flow deficiencies are common and can be addressed by managing the timing of receipts and payments. There is a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, between the Departments of Revenue, Administration, the Office of Management and Budget, and Law that outlines the steps that we follow, shown on the right half of the slide. These are taken if we anticipate a cash deficiency, and currently that's defined as forecasted cash dipping below $400 million for 5 days. This is remedied by taking or borrowing from the earnings reserve or the budget reserves. The MOU also covers the process for revenue shortfalls, which differ from cash flow timing deficiencies. A revenue shortfall occurs when revenue is insufficient to cover general fund appropriations in any given fiscal year. The legislature has historically included language to appropriate budget reserve funds for revenue shortfalls, and Treasury has relied on this appropriation to authorize use of budget reserve funds to address both revenues and shortfalls, and cash flow timing mismatches in the past.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the cash flow deficiency borrowing, was the $400 million level set in 94 when that memo was written, or has that been adjusted since?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I cannot remember what it was in 1994, but it has been set at $400 million for quite a long time, certainly since I think 2014. Was the one that I know for a fact it's been $400 million. And essentially what it is, it's a limit of the maximum of all cash outflows that could really collide on a given day to make sure that we have enough money just in the general fund proper to pay those bills. We have had instances of it going down below $400 million, but not many. As we look at our forecast, which you'll see on the next page, because we're looking to see, as cash moves in and out on a daily basis, what the forecast looks like. And if we start to see it's going to start dipping below $400 million, we adjust our cash. We call cash from whatever reserves we have on hand, whether it's the earnings reserve fund or CBR or SBR.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I guess the question really goes to, I mean, certainly in the 90s, the $400 million was a much bigger chunk of operating budget than it is today. 2014, the delta may not be nearly so big. Is it a sufficient cushion for Treasury to do what you need to do and be absolutely sure the checks don't bounce?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it is right now, and we have been averaging at a higher balance just due to negotiations with or discussions with APFC in terms of how frequently and how even we're taking money from them. It's worked out really well over the last couple of years. So we've been above the $400 million balance just due to the timing of transfers.
Senator Keel. On a higher level, there's been much discussion at this table about what an adequate number would be in the constitutional budget reserve for state security. In the past, there's been $10 billion, $5 billion. Does the Department of Revenue have any comment upon what that might be?
Chair Hoffman, I do not. We have seen balances of varying sizes described as sufficient. I will say that the Pew Institute has done an analysis of rainy day funds across many, many states, and our current balance of $2.9 billion was in 2024, I believe, the second highest balance in terms of what states have in order to cover their expenses in their operating budgets. So in terms of how our CBR fares compared to other states, currently 2.9 seems to be at the top. I think Wyoming is just higher than this.
But unlike other states, we have a very volatile situation with our revenue. We have the draw from the POMV, which is pretty predictable, but we still have a big gap between that and what our general operations are. So it may be high compared to other states, but because of our volatility, it may not be high enough. Please continue.
Thank you. On to slide 9, cash management in action. This shows forecasted and actual cash for the first half of this fiscal year. It's updated daily after cash management works with the departments, analyzes all anticipated payments and incoming revenue, and any changes they expect to the forecast. For example, if the tax department knows its oil revenue forecast is going to change, they alert us so we can update our cash forecasts as soon as they know. Another example is when there was a decision to pay a few years back the dividends earlier than what was planned. So sometimes we are anticipating funds that don't or won't be coming in. And in situations like that, like, for example, the federal government announced it was going to shut down certain payments, making sure that we have enough cash to forecast, you know, a good period of time to pay for things is important for us to do. And so the cash management team has to be responsive and able to readily react to any of those situations that arise. And now that the earnings reserve account is our primary tool in addressing cash deficits, at the start of each year, as I said, we create an expected draw schedule from the earnings reserve account with APFC based on our forecasts, and we seek to maximize the amount of money in the earnings reserve while maintaining a sufficient balance and to make sure that we don't go below our $400 million threshold. Again, we've increased the number of draws to provide greater flexibility and known liquidity needs over the years. And we have made 60 draws in 2025, totaling $26 billion over the last 8 years. And we've only had to revise our schedules a couple of times per year due to unknown circumstances. The last item on this slide highlights the integration of our cash and investment teams. Every day, based on the forecasts and planned cash flows, cash management projects cash expected to be available for investment and works with the portfolio team to ensure that all of the expected funds are fully invested. So with that, if there are no further questions, I think I will turn it over to CIO Hannah to discuss the Treasury investment process and performance.
Great. Thank you very much. For the record, I am Zach Hannah, Chief Investment Officer for the Treasury Division in the Department of Revenue. And so page 11 is a summary of the process that Treasury uses to set over 25 state investment policies for five different state fiduciaries. Commissioner Revenue is the sole fiduciary for many of the state funds that we will be covering today. And for the past 6 years, Treasury has used a formal state investment review to develop and recommend investment policy. This involves the commissioner, investment staff, and an independent investment advisory committee. We review financial markets and performance for each fund quarterly, and at least annually, we review capital market assumptions and recommend asset classes and underlying investments. And we go through each fund to recommend an appropriate investment policy and asset allocation that considers fund investment objectives and attributes like time horizon and liquidity needs. In providing counsel to state fiduciaries, Treasury's recommendations are always thoroughly vetted, adhere to state law, and are consistent with best investment practice. And full quarterly investment review packets documenting the process and the staff recommendations are available online, along with other Treasury fund information at the links provided in the appendix. And forward to page 12. This is general capital market performance information. So as everyone's aware, over the past few years, we've experienced really an extraordinary cycle. We've moved from a pandemic with near zero interest rates through surging inflation, followed by one of the fastest interest rate hiking cycles in history. Today, we have high geopolitical and trade tensions that dominate, but the capital markets have staged a strong rebound, at least through the end of the 2025 period that we'll cover today. As you can see on the far right chart, which rank orders asset class returns each year, performance was all positive last year. This was led by a 32% return for international equities and on down the list through 7% returns for fixed income and 4% for cash equivalents. So this is the backdrop for the returns that we'll go through by asset class and fund here shortly. Page 13 has performance for the asset classes that Treasury manages for state portfolios. These are all commingled investments that are used in different proportions to construct portfolios that are diversified, low cost, and have full liquidity. We manage over 80% of these internally and focus on delivering market returns with consistent upside. In the table on the right, the top section has the total performance for each asset class, followed by a section with benchmark performance, and then finally a stoplight section with performance relative to that benchmark. As you can see, returns were strong in the top section, with cash and bond returns ranging from 5 to 8% and equities up to 33%. And in the bottom benchmark relative section, the returns are strong overall. For state portfolios, most of the assets are in the first three categories, from cash through core fixed income. These are all internally managed, and Treasury has produced consistent excess returns over time. In 2025 was no exception, with excess returns from 24 to 42 basis points. That's 0.24 to 0.42%. So overall, strong positive returns across the state investment pools that we use to make up the building blocks for the state portfolios that we'll go through next. Page 14 summarizes the overall investment results for the year across the Treasury portfolios and tries to quantify some of the financial impact. So Director Lear and I have the honor of working with really a great team of professionals. They take a lot of pride in working to generate strong results for the state. Overall returns across all the funds that Treasury manages were 12.9% for the year. That's both retirement and state, resulting in $6.7 billion in total gains for the calendar year. The state funds that we'll go through today added $658 million to the state balance sheet in 2025, which is strong performance for a set of lower-risk portfolios. And the retirement systems that we'll touch on last rank in the top third of peer public pension plans, generating excess returns over the past 10 years of $2 billion over benchmark performance, which directly reduces state and employer contributions. And as we mentioned, managing significant assets internally allows for tighter control of results and material cost savings. With that, let me hand it back to Director Leary to start going through the individual funds. We'll then go back and forth as she provides the background for each fund and I cover asset allocation and performance.
Again, for the record, Pam Leary, Director of the Treasury. Slide 16, we'll discuss the savings reserve funds. The blue part of the chart shows the fiscal year end balances of the main fund of the CBRF, or Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. The fund is used for liquidity and revenue volatility management and was created in the Constitution in 1990 when voters approved adding Section 17 to Article 9 of the Constitution of the state. Deposits to the fund include all money received by the state after July 1, 1990 through resolution of disputes about the amount of certain mineral-related income. The yellow or orange area of the chart shows the amounts of the subaccount of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which legislature created in 2000. In accordance with statute, money in the subaccount shall be invested to yield higher returns than in the main fund and is used for funds that will not be needed for at least 5 years. In 2008, $4.1 billion was deposited into the subaccount and was managed to achieve a higher return than the main fund. In April 2015, the balance was returned to the main fund when it was determined that those funds would be needed within 5 years. And the gray area represents the Statutory Budget Reserve, or SBR, which was created in 1986. It was part of the GFANZ before and after being managed as a separate fund from July 2013 to October 2015, but we're showing it here to reflect total reserve accounts.
For the record, Zach Hanna with the Treasury Division. So the combination of the CBRF main account and the CBRF subaccount are on page 17. Balance have been stable at close to $3 billion for the past 3 years, but were drawn down to $1 billion the prior 2 years through the pandemic. The CBRF is the state's primary reserve fund with a potentially short time horizon. Treasury investment staff have consistently recommended an investment approach that provides full liquidity and principal protection. As shown at year-end, the combined CBRF accounts are 100% invested in cash equivalents. Historically, we have often included some longer-term bonds and at times a small level of equity exposure to enhance earnings while still protecting principal. But since yields have remained elevated for cash investments and published fiscal information doesn't support a longer time horizon, we've recommended leaving the fund invested in cash. From a performance perspective, 2025 was a good year for cash investments and the CBRF overall. The one-year performance was 4.48%, in excess of the benchmark by 20 basis points, so 0.2%. In total, this resulted in $127 million in net gains for the combined CBRF accounts in 2025. Any questions on the CBRF?
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of curious on Digital Bridge. Those monies have now been returned to the Treasury. Is that correct? And can you give us an update on that?
Through the chair to Senator Stedman. For the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner. Yes, the funds have been, they were returned to the sub-account, and then the sub-account was closed out, and all the funds in there were returned to the main account.
Okay.
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're going to bring that subject to the table after the audit comes out, because there are some concerns of the previous commissioner not following best practices, to say the least. So we'll take that subject up at a later date. But I did note, Mr. Chairman, that on page 11, when they talked about the Treasury investment process, the third bullet stated Treasury investment recommendations are consistent with state law. I don't doubt that. The concern with the previous commissioner, that sentence doesn't fit his actions. So we'll take that up at a later date.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Again, Pamela Leary, Treasury Director. Slide 18 shows the historical balances of the two Jafonzi accounts. Jafonzi is the acronym for the General Fund and other non-segregated investments. As I mentioned earlier, the General Fund is the checking account of the state where all cash flows come into and out of and where we keep a minimum floor of $400 million. There are about 185 other accounts and funds that have assets in the two Jafonzi accounts that are managed together but accounted for separately. The first Jafonzi was created in 1992 as a way to pool accounts for investment, and Jafonzi 2 was created in 2018 to target a slightly higher risk return for a subset of the funds. As of June 30th, 2025, there was $3.4 billion in the Jafonzi funds combined. We also have an appendix on slide 33 that lists the top 30 funds that roll into each of these Jafonzi accounts as of the end of December, for your interest. And the General Fund proper is the largest of these funds at that time, close to $1.5 billion.
Zach Hanna with Treasury Vision. On page 19, both Jafonzi 1 and Jafonzi 2 have a short investment horizon with a relatively high need for principal and income protection. Jafonzi 1 is 85% cash equivalents and 15% short-term bonds, and Jafonzi 2 is a modestly higher risk with 61% cash equivalents, 33% short-term bonds, and 6% equities. And similar to the CBRF, these funds have fewer long-term bonds than they have had historically. As rates normalize, you may see some additional risk added to these funds to increase earnings while still protecting principal. Performance was good for the year for both. Jafonzi 1 had a return of 4.71% and Jafonzi 2, 5.93%, both 30 basis points in excess of their benchmark. Overall, this total performance resulted in $172 million in gains during 2025.
For the record, Pam Leary. Slide 20 shows the historical asset values of the Public School Trust Fund, which ended fiscal year 2025 with $911 million. The fund has been around since 1978 and is funded by 0.5% of state receipts from the management of state lands, including mineral lease rentals and royalties. The fund is used to provide an offset to the K-12 formula funding. For fiscal year 25, the fund contributed $35 million to the Public Education Fund, and it's expected to contribute $35 million in 2026 this year and $37.5 million in fiscal year 27.
For the record, Zach Hanna on page 21. We're now turning to funds that have a long time horizon and a high ability to bear risk. Public School Trust is the first of these. We use a high-risk profile for this fund to work to both inflation-proof it and achieve the long-term statutory spending objective of up to 5% of the last 5 years' average balance. We set the risk profile for this fund and others like it at the risk equivalent of 70% equities, 30% bonds. Treasury seeks to preserve the purchasing power of this fund over time through a combination of that investment policy and spending recommendations that we make annually to the Department of Education and Early Development. Performance over the past year was high at 17.07%, modestly above its benchmark. For the year, this resulted in $141 million in gains and brings the fund to peak assets, $100 million higher than in 2021. And the 10-year compound performance has been high at 8.6%.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you remind us what the payout rate is on this portfolio?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the payout rate's 5% of the average five-year balance. That's the maximum. And Treasury makes a recommendation to DEET every year that is somewhere in between that maximum and what we believe will inflation-proof it over a forward period of 20 years. And we've been recommending the 5% maximum since it is in surplus right now.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I appreciate that 5%. But we've been having some testimony here that – 5% might be pushing it a little high on the permanent fund, and the mental health trust uses a lower rate, substantially lower. I think they're down at 4, 4.25, and their consultants recommended that they increase it to 4.5. And we're here at the table looking at the permanent fund to decrease it from 5 to 4.5. So I'd just highlight that to the department that they may want to look at this also.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Slide 22 is for the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. And the fund was capitalized with a $400 million deposit from receipts of the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation and is used to support the Alaska Performance Scholarship Awards and the Alaska Advantage Education Grants and other education uses. For this fund, up to 7% can be appropriated for scholarships. Of that amount, two-thirds go to the APS awards and one-third to the AEG grants. HB 322 established that this fund was a separate fund as of June 30th, 2022. And HB 148, passed last legislative session, increased the amounts of the scholarships and grants. At June 20, 2025, the fund held $435 million, which was then reduced by a $130 million transfer to the general fund. And we know on the table currently is recapitalizing the fund for the amount that was taken in the supplemental from the to replenish the education fund.
For the record, Zach Hanna. On page 23, the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund has the same high risk profile as the Public Schools Trust to support up to 7% annual spending on scholarships and other programs. Unlike the Public School Trust, this fund does not have a smoothing mechanism, and scholarship program spending is up to 7% of prior year's spending of the prior year's ending value in statute. It also does not require inflation proofing, and has not been inflation proof historically. Cumulative spending prior to FY26 has been roughly equal to earnings over time. Performance over the past year was strong at 17.08% in excess of its benchmark. For the year, this resulted in $61 million in gains. And the 10-year performance was 8.86%, well over expectations. So that's the good news. The challenge for this fund is that the current spending of over $30 million per year was at the fund's earning capacity prior to the $130 million reduction used to balance last year's budget. So as Pam alluded to, spending and the fund's capitalization level may need to be reconciled over the longer term.
Again, Pam Leary for the record. Slide 24 shows the historical assets of the pension and health defined benefit plans for the Public Employees Retirement System, or PERS, which is in blue, and Teachers Retirement System, or TERS, which is in yellow. These four funds totaled $32.3 billion at the end of the 25 fiscal year. As closed funds, the defined benefit plans currently experience net withdrawals annually from the funds. $1.6 billion net withdrawal occurred in fiscal year 25. Investment returns for these funds were just over 10.11% for fiscal year 2025, and the 40-year return average for PERS and TERS over fiscal years was 8.51%, which compares favorably to the current actuarial assumed rate of 8.17%. I'll turn it over to Zach to give you some more updated results.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. My apologies. The question that's in my head is from slide 23, the statement about inflation proofing. I just want to be sure we're not suggesting that it needs to be inflation proofing by saying it's not inflation-proofed. And my point to that is when you're an investor for total return and there's no artificial compartmentalization of a fund, it's inherently inflation-adjusted by the rate of the growth that's internal to the investments.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. My point in mentioning it was to note a significant distinction between the Higher Education Fund and the Public Schools Trust. Public Schools Trust, in our view, does require inflation proofing, and we manage it accordingly. Where the Higher Education Fund, if you're spending all of the nominal earnings, your expectation should be over time that expenditures on an inflation-adjusted basis will reduce. And so you basically aren't maintaining purchasing power over time if you don't inflation-proof, and that's how it's currently set up. So that's the point of mentioning it.
Senator Kaufman.
I agree. If you're pulling down, in an investment for total return for a sustained yield, you want to have the inflation proofing within the combination of your growth rate, rate of return, and have your draw rate kind of tuned up to that so that you're allowing inflation improving inherently. And the public school, going back, just mentioning that, so that's invested in, 70-30, that's invested for total return. And explain to me why that would be inflation-proofed. Is it because of its draw rate on that?
So through the chair, Senator Kaufman, just to be clear, the Higher Education Fund does not require inflation proofing, and the comment was that over time it has not been inflation proofed, and the current draw rates are consuming effectively 100% or more of the expected total nominal earnings. Okay. So the forward expectation is that the fund will not or is not expected to be inflation proofed.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Please proceed.
Okay, for the Zach Hanna, Treasury Division. So defined benefit systems are on page 25. These are Treasury's largest client. Overall, the state retirement systems represent 83% of Treasury assets under management. Three quarters of this is defined benefit plans, which I'm going to touch on here, and the remaining quarter is defined contribution, which we'll cover next. The DB systems have a more complex asset allocation since they are long-term funds with a long-term fiduciary board. They have meaningful allocations to less liquid alternative investments like private equity, private debt, and real assets. Current asset allocation is 42% public equities, 24% fixed income, and 34% alternative investments. And the returns have been strong. Here we focus on longer-term returns since having material allocations to alternatives can make shorter-term comparisons difficult or misleading. The 10-year return through December 31st was 9%, 23 basis points over the benchmark, and well in excess of the actuarial expected return. And part of this excess return is attributable to the ARM Board's lower-cost approach and use of internal management. This has led to total costs that are roughly 30% lower than the median peer, saving over $30 million per year consistently, which goes directly to the bottom line. And as mentioned earlier, performance is in the top third of returns when compared with peers, better than over 70% of other public pension systems. So overall, strong returns from the ARM Board have made meaningful contributions to retirement assets and reduced the need for higher state contributions. This completes the summary of the main funds that Treasury invests. Any questions before I turn to the participant-directed funds? Okay, so starting on page 27, the participant-directed or defined contribution plans now make up one quarter of the assets that the ARM Board is fiduciary for, $12 billion in total. In rough numbers, they're divided into the PERS and TERS defined contribution retirement plans, which are $5 billion collectively, and the supplemental benefit system at $6 billion, and the deferred compensation plan at $1 billion. In total, they serve over 100,000 participants. The ARM Board and Treasury Division are responsible for the investment structure and options, which I'll cover shortly, and the Division of Retirement Benefits is responsible for administration of the plans, including the record keeper. Page 28, the ARM Board, Treasury staff, and the ARM Board's investment consultant, Callan, provide ongoing input and review of the investment structure for the participant-directed plans. Over time, best practice has led to fewer investment options, and the Board has worked to unify the options for ease of use for participants and economies of scale. The table on the right is one way to view the options, separated into asset allocation funds that contain stocks and bonds, core funds with active management designed to provide excess returns over market benchmarks, passive core funds that provide market exposure at low cost, and specialty options. Callan last reviewed the DC options in 2023, and the board added three options and renamed several to improve the lineup. Page 29, market participants are invested in the plan's default, most participants are invested in the plan's default option, age-appropriate target date funds, which I'll cover in more detail in the next two slides. Roughly 90% of new contributions go into these funds for the defined contribution retirement plans. And overall, over 60% of the total assets are invested in the target date funds or the related balance funds, which were the prior default options. The ARM Board also has a longstanding emphasis on cost discipline, since low fees directly improve participant outcomes. Alaska's fees rank in the bottom decile compared to peer funds, better than 90% of other peer plans. The weighted average fee across the plans is 12 basis points, or 0.12%, one quarter of the level of peer median fees. Page 30, the state was an early adopter of target date.
Before you move on to page 30, Senator Stedman.
If we can go back to 29, I got a couple of issues and concerns or what have you. On the active core, the Alaska Stable Value Fund with 15,142 participants with $665 million in it. Who's investing in that? Not individual, but what category? Is it the deferred compensation, the defined contribution plans, SBS plans? Can you help me with that? And the point I'm concerned about is stable value fund, which is basically a money market fund, will never get to your retirement goals. And how do we, I'd like a little bit of definition on that, and then or what policies do we have in place so a employee doesn't come in and think the stable value fund is going to get him to a retirement amount that would match his or her desire for a salary replacement schedule.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, great question. And I guess my first comment is that default options have enormous momentum over time. And the largest reason why the stable value fund is as large as it is that it was the default option for quite some time for both SBS and the deferred comp plans. It was never the default option for the DC retirement plans, and I don't have the numbers with me, but has a much lower level of investment for the DC retirement plans than it does for SBS and deferred comp. Ultimately, these are, participant-directed plans. Folks can choose to invest as they see fit. They can choose to invest away from the default option. And so the reason for those large balances is largely due to kind of legacy, my view, the impact of legacy default options for SBS and deferred comp doesn't really influence the DC retirement systems, which, largely are defaulted into the target date funds at this point.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, I have a similar concern with the Alaska Conservative Balance Fund and the Alaska Moderate Growth Balance Fund performance relative to the age-weighted funds. It looks like they have returns that lag quite a bit, those other funds. Can you help me with that? And do we have a lot of defined contribution people in those two funds?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. Again, good question. And again, in a similar answer, you've now named all three of the legacy default options. And so almost in sequential order, the stable value was the earliest default option, followed by what we're now calling the conservative balanced fund, followed by the modest growth balance fund, and now have been followed by the target date funds. And so the DC retirement funds, happy to provide this information, but have a fairly low level of investment by the new DC plans. a much higher level investment by SBS and deferred comp. Again, my view, due to the legacy impact of those default options. The board has done some work to try to push out education to the participant base, to try to give people some, give people some additional options. And in fact, renamed both of those funds a number of years ago. The conservative, it used to be just the Alaska Balance Fund. We've inserted the word conservative and provided some educational materials trying to point to what that fund is really best used for. And same thing, moderate growth. That used to be the long-term balance fund. It is now, it's a 60-40, 60% equity, 40% bond fund. It's a more traditional balance fund, but again, has far less equity exposure than a target date fund. And I think, it's probably relatively clear, if I have one piece of advice, is the target date funds are the best fit for the average participant over their retirement life cycle. They're not going to be perfect for any one person, but they largely reflect kind of the best investment thinking over the long term. And some of these older funds are really more of a legacy investment choice that may serve a good purpose in various portfolios. If you want something that has a consistent asset allocation and you're in the right place for your portfolio or in your path through retirement, these can still be a good place. They are professionally managed. They do have low fees. But in general, target date funds are probably a better fit for most participants really across all of these plans.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that in spades, frankly. The target date funds, always a curiosity to compare, and even the other funds, active core and a passive core, and especially against the defined benefit portfolio. There's always a discussion at the table of individual lagging a particular professional investment scenario. Not taking into account you can contribute more on one side, the individual side, to compensate for that. But if they had the same amount of funds going in, the professional investor may have an advantage. But with these target date funds, pretty much appears to neutralize that. In fact, the target date funds look like they beat that portfolio on several occasions. Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So I'm happy, I guess, to address that more fully when I cover performance in a couple slides. I could touch on it now, but it probably best addressed with performance.
No, that's fine. We can wait.
Okay. So on page 30, the state was an early adopter of target date funds back in 1996, years before they became an industry standard. The funds emphasize equity exposure early in a participant's career to compound higher returns over a long time horizon, then gradually transition towards income generation and lower volatility in retirement while still working to mitigate inflation and longevity risk. The ARM Board conducts regular reviews of these funds, and in 2022 lowered the fees to less than 10 basis points while adding more value-added underlying asset classes at the same time. And just last week, the ARM Board adopted an enhanced glide path that's expected to modestly improve participant outcomes. Okay, on page 31, this is the last slide, and Senator Stedman, this should resolve some of the questions you have. And so returns for the target date funds have been very strong. The table shows returns for all the funds over various time periods. And to orient you, since there are a lot of target date funds for all the age cohorts, 80% of the assets are in funds between 2035 and 2055. So 2045 is a good one to kind of orient on, kind of as the average. The short-term results have been high, with 1 and 3 year returns of close to 20% for some of these funds. But the longer-term results are what count for compounding and wealth accumulation. And the total returns for these funds over the past 10 and 15 years have been very strong, with weighted average returns of over 10%. And Cowen compares these returns to target date funds offered by other providers and the state's peers. And the state's target dates funds have been some of the best performing target date funds over the past 15 years, better than 75 to 90% of other plans. And that wraps up the summary of the state's participant-directed plans. I could touch on Senator Stedman's question now if you'd like.
Please.
And so we have covered DB performance. I've stated in other forums, I think it is comparing apples to oranges in terms of comparing these performance numbers, but the 10-year performance for the defined contribution systems are 9%, and the 15-year performance is 8.5%. So strong DP performance. These individual target date funds are actually far less mature than the defined contribution plans. And so the way to kind of think of defined contributions in this context is as really a different weighted average of, you know, perhaps some of these cohort vintages, and including cohorts that precede these, because we have people that are well into their retirement. The weighted average life of participants in the defined contribution plans is about 45. 45 years old, and so generally still about 20 years away from retirement, whereas the DB plans, most of the participants are already retired. So they're well into that glide path if you want to think about it in the same context. But nonetheless, these returns are very strong, really above expectations. And so participants with strong savings rates have accumulated pretty significant balances compounding at these rates for the past 10 or 15 years.
Senator Stedman.
Could you repeat those returns? I didn't get them written down. You had a 10-year and an 8-year, and are these calendar?
Yeah, I'm going, excuse me.
Calendar returns, because it says on your chart here, period ending December 31st, so I assume these are all end and work on a calendar year. I was just thinking, because you had the return number for the defined benefit plan for, I think, a 10-year and an 8-year or something like that, and I didn't scribble them down.
He was using 2045 trust, I believe.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So I'm going back to page 25 and looking at, so the DB systems, the 10-year return is 9.03%, and the 15-year return is 8.47%. That's for PERS.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, and that ends That ends on December.
Yes,
December.
And so those line up to the same time period. Okay. Since we're giving this presentation a little bit later than we typically do, we are able to include the calendar year-end returns for the DB systems, so they actually line up with the same cumulative ending period as these target date funds. And so if we turn back to page 31, if you want to just use the 25 as your comparative, the target date 2045 trust, the 10-year return is 11.53%, and the 15-year return is 10.79%. Okay. But as you look up and down the table, you can see as you move towards less risky funds at the top of the table here, the returns are quite a bit lower. And I guess my point on the DB systems is it really represents a much more mature population that really requires a lower investment risk posture to accommodate the pretty significant outflows. And so the DB systems combined have about 5% net outflows right now. Whereas when you take a look at these target date funds, these are all inflows. There really aren't any net outflows. They're significant inflows. If you talk about PERS plus SBS, you're talking about 25% of salary that's going into these each year. And so they have no cash flows to take care of. So,
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, thank you. And then on the SBS, we don't talk about the supplemental benefit system very much here. In fact, nobody likes to talk about it in the building, and I think it's not because it's bad, it's because it's really good. And it's a replacement for those at home that are watching for Social Security that the state put in. But could you help us with what the average return is and compounded return on the supplemental benefit systems account? And I know they're all a little different, but we should be able to average out the aggregate to get the average return annually of the participant, because the account balances are significant. And when you're looking at $800,000 to $900,000 for somebody that's been in the system for 25 years or so, right under $1 million. In fact, some people are well over $1 million. So it's a huge impact on retirement. And those returns are very good. And that's why the earlier comment I made about people don't talk about it, it's not because it's bad, it's because it's good, and I think it's like the best kept state secret.
Go ahead. Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So I guess, first of all, thank you. I'm a 23-year beneficiary of being in SBS, and I think you're right. I think it is a absolutely wonderful program, for state retirees. And so in terms of a weighted average performance, I don't have those numbers with me. We did that calculation for the DCR systems, and it was 10.3% over the past 15 years. I can do that calculation for deferred comp and SBS as well and provide that to you. It will be lower for the reasons that you identified early on. There were some legacy default options that still have, material assets. Nonetheless, I expect that those returns would be very strong.
I'd like that.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman, I think it's, when we have really good results, we should talk about it. And we always get problems here. They don't come to see the Senate Finance Committee because things are going good. There's something going on. Or they're asking for money. And in this case, we've got very good performance. We've got a very good program statewide. And we should let people know that how successful it is.
Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
Well, I was just going to say it just doesn't happen by happenstance. It happens because we have folks like sitting at the end of this table at work all day long trying to ensure that there's performance and people are taken care of. It just doesn't happen like an apple falling out of a tree.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll echo Senator Stedman's applause for the dedicated team and the work they do. The results are pretty impressive. Mr. Hanna, we're looking back 15 years, and I think there's a lot of value in taking a long-term look, but of the last 15 years, we've been in a pretty remarkable situation. How many of the last 15 years have been bear market years instead of bull?
Mr. Hanna?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, I'd have to get back to you on that exact number. It's a low number. I mean, this is certainly a very strong period of time for equity performance. The number 15 years wasn't chosen randomly. We didn't cherry pick that number. That is effectively the life of the DCR systems, and that's there's actually a 16-year number, but the numbers are very similar to what you see here. That's as long as we have really data to calculate some of these returns. But your point, I think, is a well-taken one. This is an extraordinary period from a cumulative perspective in terms of equity performance or in terms of capital market performance. And so these returns are in excess of what was expected, prior to experiencing this period, and likely are higher than someone should expect, moving forward over long periods of time.
Senator Keel,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that because I think that's important. I think, and you'll know better than I do. I think the first year of the last 15 was a bear market year, and then 6 or 7 weeks in 2020.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's all been on a great tear, and thank goodness. I think we all benefit. The question that follows from that then is resilience to the next downturn, because there's always going to be one. And can you provide a little sort of comparison or sense of where we are in terms of the various things with resistance to, with a chance to minimize loss as opposed to take a fat loss.
So through the chair, Senator Keel. And so resilience is a great question, and it's one that we think about differently for defined contribution than we do for defined benefit. And a lot of it has to do with cash flows and asset liability matching and participant behavior at some level. And so on the defined benefit side, with strong cash outflows, that again, when I talk about a 5% you know, kind of average outflow at this point in time. That's a hard dollar, 5%. That's really a dollar figure that in a significant market downturn, that 4 or 5% becomes 7 or 8% pretty quickly. And so you have to have a portfolio that can accommodate those cash flows and can still remain, remain with its strategic kind of risk exposure to generate returns over time. And so that really mandates a lower risk posture. And we have some additional diversification in the DB systems as well with those alternative investments that help provide some of that ballast that we believe is necessary to accommodate those cash flows on an annual basis. You have a much different situation in the defined contribution landscape, and it has everything to do with those cash outflow expectations and the time horizon that participants have to compound returns. The target date funds are modestly less diversified than the DB systems. They don't have some of these more exotic asset classes for a variety of reasons that we could talk about, but they don't have them. And so those are volatility reducers that in isolation are quite useful, but are less necessary on the defined contribution from a defined contribution standpoint, since you have such incredibly long compounding periods with no cash outflows. And you have participant behavior really working to benefit participants over time, in that these default options are incredibly sticky. There's been observations at the table about the stable value fund and the balance funds. Why are there such large balances in those now when it appears the target date funds are really kind of a better option? And that is that participant behavior and the stickiness of those investment options at work. The same thing is expected to accrue to the target date fund participants over time in a downturn. And so the front end, if you look at that glide path chart, the front end of these target date funds is very heavily invested in equities, 90% plus equity exposure early in a participant's career, because they have such a long time horizon and are not likely to trade out of that fund over the short term through a small market downturn. And so you have that long compounding period and the fact that from a forward expectation standpoint, you expect the high volatility of equities to decay over time and ultimately those returns to accrue to beneficiaries and them not really to feel the exposure of that of the high expected volatility that occurs at the front end of that glide path. And as you can kind of see, that glide path does go down pretty materially as you enter kind of that retirement phase. And down quite a bit as you move through retirement to reduce that volatility and be more responsive to the expected cash outflows at that time once participants are in retirement. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, it's helpful. It doesn't contain some assumptions about participant behavior that aren't always true. The conservative allocations are very sticky through a downturn because you hear about the market dropping 20% and yours only dropped 10. The risky allocations tend to drive panic behavior in individuals rather than professional investors. So that's it's a trade-off. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you for accolades that Senator Stedman and Senator Keel have given the department. I'd like to say that the power cost equalization is fine and doing well in its new home at the Permanent Fund Corporation. Good. And I would say that it's thriving. Good. Just for your information. Any closing comments?
No, we certainly appreciate everybody's time. Thank you.
Any final comments or questions from finance members? Seeing none. That concludes this afternoon's meeting. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We have five items on the calendar for tomorrow morning. Senate Bill 164, eliminate tax discounts. SGR 29, constitutional amendment for education fund. SB 170, gaming, electronic pull tabs. SB 167, crime overtures receipt passed EFD, Senate Bill 130, fisheries product development tax credit. With that, we are adjourned.